Take a network break. Dunk your virtual donut in a coffee container and join us for our weekly efforts to peel away layers of tech marketing and try to find out what's really going on. I'm Drew Conroy Murray. The other voice you're going to hear is not, in fact, Greg Farrow. He's at large in Europe, taking a little time off, so Ethan Banks has kindly stepped in to take his place. Ethan, which one of us is doing the Australian accent this morning?
Which, it's not me, man. It's too early in the morning for this. You said virtual coffee. I'm going with real coffee. That is what I need this time of the day to make things happen. So I'm afraid we'll have to be sands down under this morning.
All right. You just have to do with American accents for your news briefing this week. Before we get started, our sponsor today is ThousandEyes. They give you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, both internal and external, so you can migrate to the cloud, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experience. Sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/PacketPushers. And while you're there, you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. And don't forget, the Packet Pushers are hosting another virtual design clinic. This is a live online event featuring deep dive technical presentations, Q&As with expert panelists, and of course, the Packet Pushers. It's October 11th, 2018. It's free. You can get details and register at packetpushers.net/VDC. We'll be talking about that a little bit more later, but first, let's get to the news. Microsoft Ignite conference took place last week, and a couple of news items jumped out at us, including partnerships with Riverbed and VMware. Both Riverbed and VMware have announced that their SD-WAN products are going to integrate with Azure Virtual WAN. Ethan, what's going on here?
Yeah, Azure Virtual WAN, a virtual network that lets you set up site-to-site connections between branches and remote offices. Traffic's going to run from a branch through a Microsoft hub out to another branch, and I think the most interesting bit to me here is just the number of different companies that are making it a point to make it easier for you to connect to Azure. Because for so long, it's just been AWS and all the talks about AWS. But we're seeing an increasing number of people that are leveraging public cloud, doing some of that in Azure. And integrating with Azure is all the rage. So with Riverbed and VMware both, they're making it easy from within their boxes to plumb a connection using their SD-WAN tech right into that virtual WAN. So it's more or less an easy button. If you're invested in these SD-WAN technologies, now connecting up to Azure Virtual WAN just got a lot easier.
Yeah, I think the idea is that they're providing essentially a direct internet breakout to like things like Office 365, which a lot of enterprises use. That'll get you to the nearest Microsoft POP, and then the traffic goes over an IPsec tunnel. So you're presumably improving performance instead of having to like pin back to the data center and then head out to the internet. This is Riverbed Steel Connect. That's their SD-WAN product. So they've got this easy button with Microsoft Azure, as does NSX VeloCloud. There are other partners also on the list. They include Barracuda, Checkpoint, Palo Alto, Citrix, and more. We've got a link if you want to find out more. There's another story coming out of Microsoft Ignite. They announced a network tap service for Azure for the virtual network tap. And this is pretty much what it sounds like. You can stream packets from your Azure VMs through this tap to a third-party packet broker. And from there, you can send it to third-party tools for things like security and performance monitoring.
Yes. So this is visibility in the public cloud is one of those increasingly necessary things. Well, it's never not increasingly necessary. It's always been necessary, but it's been a little hard to do depending on the product you're using. A lot of products have had features they've announced in this space. And so Microsoft getting on board with the VTAP to make that even easier makes sense. And they have partnerships with the people that you'd expect, people that we've actually talked about in this space that do some of this kind of work, like Big Switch, Ixia, Gigamon, someone I haven't heard of actually, Nubiva, and others that do a packet broker kind of services. ExtraHop, RSA, NetScout are in that list as well.
Yeah, I got a briefing from ExtraHop yesterday before we recorded about their RevealX security and analytics product. This is essentially where you send traffic data to RevealX and it monitors and looks for anomalies and so on. And now they can run this inside your Azure deployments and they'll utilize this virtual network tap to get the packets. Mm-hmm. Just a note that virtual network tap is still in preview mode. It's not officially been launched yet. There's no word when it's going to go GA, but I presume Microsoft is eager to get this out because according to them, and I haven't actually looked at Amazon or Google to see, they're the first major cloud provider to offer this kind of service. So I think that for them feels like a feather in the cap.
Yeah, and hopefully they won't go like Google and just keep it beta forever.
Right. Or kill it after it comes out and people start using it. All right, moving on. SolarWinds, they have filed with the SEC for an IPO. They're going to take the company back onto the public market. The IT management vendor is aiming to raise as much as $500 million.
Yeah, back onto the public market. That was interesting. I believe their symbol, if it's approved, will be SWI. And right, second return to the public market. They were acquired back in 2015 by private equity firm Silver Lake and Thomas Bravo in a $4.5 billion deal. And now they want to go back, raise some more funds, and continue their growth. That is what SolarWinds has been all about as we've watched them. I mean, they're a company we know pretty well, Drew, and they've done a lot of acquisitions. They're big in an awful lot of enterprise IT shops and other places, and growth seems to be what they're all about.
Absolutely. I was looking at their prospectus. They say they have 275,000 customers, which is pretty good. And a key strategy to drive that growth are those customers. Their plan is to upsell existing customers on additional SolarWinds services. From the prospectus, they quote, "We are well positioned to help identify additional products that offer further value to those customers." So I'm sure you can expect a friendly SolarWinds sales rep with donuts and a list of other products that you might want to buy.
Yeah. This does make me ponder, though, as I was reading through this story. I mean, would you buy SolarWinds stock? Let's say it all goes through, the listing is public now. And so the question then to ask is does SolarWinds have the tooling, all of the tools they say they can help identify additional products that would offer further value to their customers? Okay. well, do they in fact have the tooling to support those customers as they move increasingly to hybrid cloud? To public cloud generically, private cloud internally, hybrid cloud more broadly. If you think the answer is yes, SolarWinds got that tooling, then great. They're going to be able to retain existing customers. They're going to earn some new business and follow that growth pattern. But if you think SolarWinds is falling behind being able to help their customers with that new tech, hybrid cloud that they're adopting, then I would expect in the long haul, we're talking years here, I would expect to see revenues kind of flatten and decline. The good news for SolarWinds, though, on this front, the market they serve, I mean, they tend to adopt new technology kind of slowly and tend to be brand loyal. Mm-hmm. So SolarWinds' strategy may be exactly perfect here.
And while the company was still private just this last year, they made a couple of acquisitions. So it seems like they're willing to spend money to go out and fill perceived holes in their portfolio, including a couple of cloud-based companies. So in terms of wanting to have everything that a customer could ever need, it seems like that's a very clear part of the strategy going forward.
And we certainly know that strategy has worked for some giants like Cisco.
That's right. And I think SolarWinds also has a pretty robust user community, right?
Oh, huge. They have a THWACK community, a lot of people helping people, and they have a way of making fans where people really like their technology and will wave flags for it. So, yeah, again, going back to that, would you buy SolarWinds stock? I think a lot of things are in their favor, but it's one of those where you do need to watch what they're doing as the technology shift in the enterprise is on over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, and just one more note from the prospectus. They haven't had to report public financials because they've been private for a while, but with this IPO offering, they do have to lift the kimono a little bit. They're bringing in revenue, $399 million from January to June 2018, but they also posted losses of $229 million over that same period. So growth is on the table. We'll have to see if revenue matches.
Why, that loss number seems a little bit high. I wonder if that was due to acquisitions or other unusual expenses.
Yeah, not sure. But now that they'll be coming back on the public market, more of an opportunity to poke and prod. Okay, moving on. Cisco has put out a blog touting recent successful tests of a Nexus switch supporting 400 gigabit Ethernet. There's not a lot of detail about the box or even when it's going to be generally available, or who besides a very small number of companies would want one, but they're touting it as a milestone and sort of a proof point that 400 gig Ethernet is real.
It is. 400 gig is real. This has been being talked about for a while. I was at a Tech Field Day presentation back in November 2017, so getting to be almost a year ago, where Arista was talking about 400 gig Ethernet and some of the technical hurdles that need to be overcome to bring that to market. And I think a lot of those hurdles are past now. We've got the standards are in place, the IEEE 802.3bs. Sorry, guys, they picked BS. That is what it is. But that is the real thing. 802.3bs is the 400 gig and also 200 gig standard. Incidentally, they threw 200 gig in there because it's half the channels of the 400 gig. It's not like it was a lot of extra work for them to do it, is what I read about it. Right, so why not? So that standard specs 400 G base SR16, 200 G base DR4. 200G-based FR4 and 200G-based LR4 and other 400G-based varieties there, what the signaling is going to be, and so on. So all of that's in place. Manufacturers are making the optics to deal with this. It is multi-lane technology. In other words, it's not a single wave that's handling this. You have internally, you've got multiple lanes of traffic. At, like, for example, one of the specs for the 400G-based DR4, just to pick one, is four lanes of 100 gig PAM4 over four parallel single-mode fibers up to a distance of 500 meters, et cetera. So you've got a lot of parallel technology in here, which is not new. That is how a lot of the more recent and faster Ethernet speed standards have been adopted. So it's there. And the headline, Drew, in there that Cisco had in that particular article wasn't just 400 gig. It was, they were making a point that, hey, this brings terabit scale Ethernet networking to reality. So if you take 400 gig links and then pair them in parallel links, which is a very common technique that's used, now you're actually up to terabit in a single link. So, okay, that's crazy bonkers, right?
I mean,
who needs this?
Bonkers.
Yeah, who needs this stuff? And I think who needs it? You got to be a hyperscale or a service provider scale typically, because what you're looking at is the need to aggregate. You've got lots of high volume feeds coming into various center points and trunks and need to have big, big, big links like a superhighway to carry traffic between major points. And that does speak back to the standard, where the 802.3bs standard does have 2 kilometer and 10 kilometer distance links, which is aimed again at those service providers that are trying to go longer distance between COs perhaps to carry that traffic.
Right. And of course, we hear predictions about the growth in bandwidth consumption because of things like video, because of applications out at the edge, particularly IoT devices, connected cars. They're all going to be generating data, and that data has to travel across a pipe to be processed and have applications run on it. So yeah, presumably there's a constituency for this.
Yeah, pair that with the continued growth of cord cutting and people streaming Netflix, mm-hmm. et cetera. That's certainly an addition to the mix here. But I think there's some other use cases just worth throwing out. I was on a podcast the other day chatting with some folks about, well, are you using 100 gig? And the answer was, well, it's cheap enough now that it makes a lot of sense just to use 100 gig in between the tiers of a leaf spine architecture. You know, why not? Helps your oversubscription ratios. That makes sense. Do you actually fill a 100 gig pipe? Well, not too often, unless you, again, have the size that we're talking about. And I think also high performance computing could be interesting here, where everything is latency sensitive, very large data sets getting moved around. That also might be an interesting use case for 400 gig.
Yeah, sure. I was at a security meeting, sort of a meetup the other day, and talking to somebody who builds networks for high performance computing and academic organizations. And he said the minimum file size that they're dealing with is a petabyte, 1 petabyte file size.
Goodness. <He's> That's huge. Wow. A petabyte. Anyway, so 400 gigs here, folks. It's a real. We're going to see it productized over the next year, I suspect. You're going to be able to buy. We're in the testing phases, the interoperability testing phase now, and coming soon to a network near you, 400 gig.
All right, a quick break from the news to tell you about today's sponsor, ThousandEyes. They help organizations deliver business-critical services by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app, including apps like Office 365 and Salesforce. They've got an unmatched distribution of vantage points that includes cloud agents, enterprise agents, and endpoint agents. They use these agents to gather unique insights on behavior, topologies, and how that affects network performance. Intuitive visualizations break down complex performance issues across networks that you own and those you don't, which can reduce troubleshooting time and precisely pinpoint root causes. You can generate performance data through active monitoring techniques from global vantage points, correlate multiple layers of performance data from layer 7 to layer 3, from BGP routing and DNS, so you can quickly identify problem areas and reduce your mean time to repair. You can also pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, hijacks, route leaks, and more. And you can save all these events in dashboards and metrics and visualizations so that you can share them with vendors and customers and service providers to collaboratively resolve problems faster. They've got a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. You can sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. That's thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, and choose a free t-shirt. Thousand Eyes, thrive in a connected world. Okay, back to the news. There was an article in CRN recently with Michael Dell saying that he's seeing a significant amount of cloud repatriation occurring. That is, Enterprises are pulling back applications and data and workloads from the public cloud over concerns about, quote, cost, performance, and security.
I don't know what to think about this. Okay, I've heard some of these things, too. It's a little suspect coming from Mr. Dell for fairly obvious reasons.
Wow, who else has a stake in wanting people to build out private clouds?
I know, right?
Somebody who just bought EMC and has $50 billion in debt and needs people to buy hardware.
On the other hand, maybe there's a point there. Cost. Oh, so people that have done the lift and shift approach, I'm going to replicate in the public cloud what I've been doing in my private data center, and they just pick up a virtual machine and move it into the cloud and run it there. That is not the most efficient way to utilize cloud resources. And so the talk is, you need to refactor your applications. And depending on what sort of an app you're running, it really means you may have to do a ground up rebuild, redesign of that app and redeploy it so that you're more efficiently using cloud to drive those costs down. Performance I've heard described as horrible designs where you just throw things in the cloud and don't actually think about things like latency characteristics of your application, and that can really make your performance suffer. Security feels overblown to me. I mean, the cloud data centers tend to be some of the most highly secure physical infrastructures where the data is actually physically kept. And then the cloud technology's proven that, yes, you're on a shared infrastructure, but keeping you isolated from other folks is not especially mysterious. How that's done is known, and I'm not aware of major exploits where someone's public cloud account was compromised and therefore other people sharing that infrastructure were also compromised. I've never heard of such of a breach like that. I don't think that's a typical thing.
Which doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but most of the security incidents that we hear about and that we report on here at Network Break tend to be misconfigurations by people using cloud services like those publicly addressable S3 buckets. I wonder if the security issue is, like we talked about that virtual tap earlier, more tied to visibility and compliance, where organizations feel like, I don't know if I'm meeting my compliance requirements in the cloud because I just can't see what's going on in there. So I can't say to the auditor, yes, we're secure. I can't, get that kind of sign off. Maybe that's what they're talking about.
I think there is some of that for sure. Being compliant with specific regulations may eliminate public cloud as an option depending on what the standard is you need to be compliant with and how it is written. So, for example, I used to work in a PCI environment, and the way the standard was written back in the day, although in some places it was hopelessly vague, some of the specific guidelines required us to do things and or prevented us from doing other things that we might have liked to do just based on the way they were written. So to make the auditor happy and be compliant with PCI, you had to do, in some cases, things we were like, okay. Could be we're running into some of that where more modern public cloud deployments are just eliminated from consideration because of the way the standard is written.
Right. And I can see, teasing Michael Dell about having definitely a horse in this race. But I also think there is a few nuggets of truth here. Obviously, we've all heard the stories about public cloud being like, Hotel California. It's easy to check in, but much harder to check out, especially when you start getting significant amount of data in there. Folks who are expecting public cloud to be cheaper are going to be sorely disappointed. And we are now having more options in private cloud like hyperconverged infrastructure and the gradual adoption of SDN in the data center that make building out a private cloud much more feasible than it was, even 3 years ago.
Much more feasible. And the products keep coming to market that give you that so-called easy button. For example, Big Switch Networks, their most recent announcement is about the cloud first, their cloud first initiative that's their marketing slogan lately.
That's right. Although I should also note about that, what they're essentially saying is you can build essentially a copy of an Amazon VPC in your private data center. So they're taking that cloud model and abstraction and just bringing it on premises.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They're that easy button for the building out a cloud in your own private data center. That feels very Amazon-like in how your developers consume those resources.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that, again, there may be some nuggets of truth here. We're also seeing the cloud providers themselves being very interested in getting a toehold in the enterprise data center. So at VMware's VMworld conference earlier this year, Amazon announced a partnership where you can run Amazon RDS, the relational database service, on VMware inside the data center. So you're essentially using the private data center as another Amazon availability zone. We've talked about Amazon bringing Snowball and storage gateways, hardware devices, again, onto the data center or out at the edge. So getting that enterprise sort of foothold. And of course, Microsoft Azure is working on an Azure Stack, I think, which is going to be like essentially a private cloud deployment of Azure on your premises. So I think there is some truth here that, you know, private cloud's not dead. Public cloud, I don't think there's a massive exodus as much as people might be saying, but folks are coming to a realization that, as we always learn with new technology, it is not a nirvana. There's no silver bullet.
And let's not forget that the growth we're seeing in Amazon Web Services continues to be tremendous.
That's right. Yeah, that's a very clear data point that public cloud is, you know, there's not a mass exodus.
Right.
This is a related story. Hyperconverged infrastructure revenues are exploding. Revenue grew 78% year over year in the second quarter of 2018. That is according to the latest numbers from IDC. In their report, they break out hyperconverged in two ways, based on the HCI software providing the core capabilities or by the brand on the box. On the software side, Nutanix and VMware, they are the runaway leaders. They each have quarterly revenues of nearly $500 million and each control just over a third of the market share. Cisco and HPE are at 5.3% and 4.9% market share, respectively. So some, I guess they would say, opportunity for growth there.
Yes. Well, and another sub-headline here was Nutanix actually edging out VMware in this stat by a tenth of a percent, which I would call statistically insignificant, but still yes. Notable that Nutanix is apparently at the top of the pile, at least yeah. With these latest numbers.
I'm sure they're launching press release after press release on that.
But I am shocked by the overall growth of this market. Well, I say shocked. Okay, that's a bit dramatic, but 2017 Q2 total, so this is going back a year, was $816.6 million, while 2018 Q2 is $1,454,000,000. Wow, almost $1.5 billion there for this market. And my take on this, there's a couple of points here. One, if you go hyperconverged, that is an all-in commitment for you. You're trading ultimate flexibility, which you would get if you built your own, for ease of management, quick deployment, cloud integration, maybe your own private cloud capabilities, or presumably your own. Not necessarily, but hopefully. And if an organization needs their infrastructure to just work, HCI provides that promise, and they're seeing enough wins with this technology to keep buying and investing in it at a tremendous growth rate. So it's not the adoption that's so amazing to me, just so much as how rapidly this adoption is happening. There must have been a lot of refresh cycles going on this year.
Well, I think it, you know, sort of gets back to our cloud conversation. If you're an organization concerned about putting sensitive data or applications in the public cloud, but your developers are clamoring for something simple to access and get up and running on, then you trundle out the HCI and say, there you go, fellas, have at it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's also interesting that the Cisco market share there, Cisco and HPE, I mean, HPE's had their struggles with market share in a lot of different markets. So that's not surprising so much. Cisco has, by all regards, with their HyperFlex product, UCS line, very well-regarded products in the UCS space. Mm-hmm. So you'd think they'd maybe pick up some more wins. So I'll be interested to see if the, you know, in another year, if they've made any headway that way.
Based on the numbers I saw, they are growing year over year, but just not at the same pace as Nutanix and VMware/Dell. We're walking away with it so far.
Well, then that follows the enterprise buying pattern. You tend to buy what you've been buying and go with what you know if there's something your incumbent offers you that that looks like it's going to keep working for you.
That's right. All right, we've got some open networking news. The Linux Foundation has officially admitted Tungsten Fabric as a project in the LF Networking Group. This is sort of a subgroup within the Linux Foundation dedicated to networking. And Tungsten Fabric, which is formerly known as Open Contrail, that's an SDN platform for networking in private and hybrid clouds. And it was contributed to the Linux Foundation by Juniper Networks, which also offers its own commercial Contrail product.
Yes, and this is news out of the Open Networking Summit Europe that is happening this week as we're recording this. Tungsten Fabric has announced not just that admission and full final admission into the Linux Foundation, but also a 5.01 release. And with 5.0, they announced several major features. Several of those, just to highlight some of them, the ability to deploy Tungsten Fabric in a microservice architecture. You get support for distributed source network address translation, which sounds like a big boring acronym, but it's actually sort of cool in that if you distribute source NAT tables to the different gateways in your Tungsten Fabric, that means as traffic goes to and from your workload providers in that Tungsten Fabric, you can exit via any gateway. And there's a table that's been synchronized no matter which device you enter or exit from, and the NATs can go as expected. That's sort of a big deal, gives you some traffic optimization, and gives you some redundancy in case you have a gateway failure. So I thought that was a nifty feature, having been in an environment where being able to share NAT tables between gateway devices mattered a whole heck of a lot for some of the customer designs that that we were supporting. Tungsten Fabric also supports implementing Kubernetes network policy using the Tungsten Fabric firewall security policy framework. So they've done some stitching there in the background to enable an easier integration between those two. So Tungsten Fabric moving along, integrating with Kubernetes and giving you a richer set of capabilities. And hey, 5.0 sounds like maturing, right? A lot of iterations. You can't really tell with these version numbers what that really means, but it does feel like, I mean, OpenContrail before it became Tungsten Fabric, it's got some years behind it.
It really does. It's been out for a long time. One thing that jumped out at me from the press release is that talking about now they have a microservices architecture option, they contrasted that to a monolithic container, which is the first time I'd heard that phrase, monolithic container, making it sound big and kludgy and awful. And I'm like, wait a minute. What?
And I think that this was an interesting point to me as well, where they're really saying, okay, Tungsten Fabric, we've architected the Tungsten Fabric as microservices, and you can deploy it as in a microservices architecture. It's not that it gives you more ability with microservices, that it itself is deployed as microservices instead of, right, just as you noted there in their text, a monolithic container or monolithic containers for the different components of the fabric, which was fascinating. And I thought it was a good reminder that containers are not microservices. You know, a container is a form factor. It doesn't mean you've re-architected your application to work in microservices.
That's right. And I think the general point they were making is that with the microservices architecture, you can upgrade or change components of the application without having to, you know, pull down and reboot the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, very much.
All right, a quick break to tell you about Virtual Design Clinic, Virtual Design Clinic 2. This is the second one we've done. It's October 11th, 2018. It's a live event starting at 11 a.m. Eastern, 1600 British time. It's free to sign up. You can watch it live, and we'll also have videos of the whole event on Ignition, so you can watch at your leisure. Ethan, you've been busily assembling guests and speakers and content. What's going on for VDC 2?
So VDC 1, just to level set a little bit, was a six-hour event, and the way we laid it out, it was a little long for folks, so we've re-architected it to be a four-hour event for VDC 2.
And we're is it going a microservices to do, architecture?
Not quite. We're going to do three 45-minute sessions, and in between each of those 45-minute sessions, we're going to have Ask Me Anything segments as well across those 4 hours. So the technical presentations that we've been able to recruit so far, we're going to create some virtual networks with Terraform, cloud networking. We've got Ned Balavance coming in for that. We're going to talk to Andrey Kormakov, who's done a few podcasts with us about his open networking architecture and some of what he's done with Cumulus and how they do monitoring and so on. And he's going to spend some time diving in deeper with Puppet and how they use Puppet in that environment, if you listen to those shows we've done with Andrey. And then Pete Lumbus is a friend to the networking community. He works over at Cumulus Networks. He's going to talk to us about understanding ASICs and switch internals. He's working on a presentation for that. And then the AMA segments, we've got some of these guys are going to be on the AMA panel. And that is literally an ask me anything. Ask this panel anything that's on your mind, and we'll do our best to give you some kind of an answer. We don't have a sponsor for this one. So this is all it's all us. Just come on in and chat. No sponsors are looking. We can just come on in and have a conversation. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's one of my very favorite things that we do at Packet Pushers are these live events where we get to interact with folks like you that are listening. Hopefully go on up to packetpushers.net/VDC. Register. The webinar platform only holds so many people, so you do need to register to be able to get at it. But if you can't, hey, you can go up to ignition.packetpushers.net and watch the videos once we've completed the recordings and got them edited.
Yeah, that's right. So check out packetpushers.net/VDC to get the details and sign up and mark your calendars for October 11th. It's going to be a fun time. All right, back to the news. Barefoot has launched P4 Studio. This is software to streamline ASIC programming, specifically the Tofino ASIC available from Barefoot.
Yes. I think most of the folks listening to this are going to be like, I don't know that I care about this. But there's something important here to highlight, which is if you followed programmable ASICs and P4 and what Barefoot is doing with Tofino, some of the different folks that are using Tofino or making switches that are based on the Tofino chip, you start to wonder just how deep into the networking ecosystem programmable ASICs are going to go. Barefoot's really got something here. So with P4 Studio, what they're doing is they're enabling Tofino programmability in a robust and flexible way. And if you're a developer, now you've got a software development environment, Barefoot P4 Studio. That's what's happened here. It's a complete suite of tools for development, debugging, and optimizing P4 applications. I'm reading some of these bits from their press releases explaining what the tool is all about. So the challenge here, if you're thinking about this, it's like, don't we have lots of software development environments? I don't get it. Okay, we're programming the chip. And so programming the chip in a particular language designed to allow you to do fancy packet manipulation as a packet traverses the ASIC is the key here. That's the magic. And making it easier for developers to do this, including visualizing what's going to happen as the packet traverses the path, should accelerate applications. So now you have some kind of an interesting use case, some kind of a software-defined networking sort of a use case, and you want to do some really interesting packet manipulation depending on some set of complex criteria. Now you've got a more robust P4 ecosystem where your conception of what you'd like to see happen can be brought to life more readily, more support from Barefoot for P4. It's easier to bring these applications to life and debug them and develop them. So the key features here, there's a faster P4 compiler. There's a tool called P4 Insight for data plane visualization. There's a Python-based packet testing framework. There's a unified device driver and even more stuff. We don't have time to go through all the things. But they talk about this plenty on their website and in their announcement. And there's a video by Kaloom, K-A-L-O-O-M, Kaloom Flow Fabric. They're a user of Tofino and Barefoot and P4 Studio. And there's about a 3.5-minute video where they talk about how they're using the tool and how it made life easier as they bring their SDN fabric to life. So pretty cool stuff.
Getting into the guts of the ASIC programming right at the data plane is a tricky proposition. I think Barefoot recognizes that. And so it sort of behooves them to roll out tools and software that makes this a little easier, a little more graspable, gives folks some framework and some tools to work with so that they can actually start taking advantage of this ASIC for those use cases. You said that maybe they've got certain business drivers that are would compel someone to actually get down into the guts of the ASIC.
And then for third parties like Kaloom that are building a fabric based on Tofino, it makes it easier for them to monetize, I think is a good way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right, some security news. Cisco last week announced that a hard-coded root account was discovered in its video surveillance manager appliance. In a security advisory, the company wrote that the vulnerability, quote, could allow an unauthenticated remote attacker to log in to an affected system by using the root account, which has default static user credentials. As we all know, a root account is not a great thing to expose.
Come on.
An article in the Register surmises that a Cisco developer created the account at some point and forgot to remove it. I note that Cisco has had to fix at least a half dozen other hard-coded backdoors in its products this year. I'm glad they're taking care of it, but you know these are kind of rookie errors.
It speaks to the size of Cisco, right? I mean, and we've mentioned before that effectively they're not one company. There are a whole bunch of companies under one umbrella, the way the different products and development teams work and so on. It's almost a little harsh to just say, Cisco screwed up again, because it's really one BU, you know, one developer, right? Probably absentmindedly had put something in. I'm going to fix that. Fell off the plate for whatever reason, got forgotten about, and someone discovered it. So it is a bit of a rookie mistake. It is one of those things you do quickly for convenience. I'm going to fix that later. Oops, I forgot about it. Oh crap, it's out in the wild.
What a conversation they would have to have going to their higher ups to say, I was just looking at my notes and oh boy.
It is what it is, but it's a reminder for all of us that best security practices and so on, and trying to prevent people from ever getting at one of these devices, you know, if your video surveillance manager appliance is protected in an appropriate way, there's less chance that you would be victimized by such a vulnerability. So, hey, it's also important for those of us that are practitioners to make sure we protect our systems in a common sense way to limit the effect that rookie vulnerabilities like that might have on us.
Yeah, I understand you're trying to acknowledge that we're dealing with complex systems and it's a human error and forgivable, but it's also a little bit unfortunate that essentially we have to design our systems to protect ourselves from the people selling us these systems. And it's a little unfortunate, but it is what it is.
There's a larger conversation to have here because there's also issues with applications that have the same thing. And gosh, that is what network security is really all about, preventing us from badly designed systems. Because if they're all designed perfectly, we wouldn't have things like SQL injection and statically coded root credentials and things like that. Right. So yeah, we as network practitioners are always the people who have to prevent the worst from happening because of a crappy code.
Well, we've got a link to the vulnerability announcement if you want to find out how to mitigate, where to get the latest software update to take care of it. So check the show notes. All right, this is the last bite for today's episode. Salesforce had its Dreamforce conference in San Francisco, and like other big tech shows, Salesforce put on a concert for attendees, and the headliner was Metallica. Not only did Metallica play, Salesforce's Mark Benioff brought drummer Lars Ulrich onto the keynote stage to talk about how Metallica uses Salesforce Marketing Cloud to engage with its fan base. And I was like, wow, this is the least metal thing I have ever heard.
That is so funny. I remember Lars back in the 80s making the news because he'd play the drums in his underpants because he sweat so much. He'd strip right down. And it was like a big thing that he would play with the biggest drumsticks you could get. These things were like hiking staffs, you know, these huge pieces of wood he just beat the drum kit out of. And now, decades later, he's up on stage. Ah, I'm Lars. Let's talk about Salesforce Marketing Cloud. Boom. Yes. Roar.
I think some of his tattoos just sort of slunk away. Like, I can't believe this is happening. This is, I'm embarrassed to be here.
Priceless.
Instead of Enter Sandman, they can sing Enter CRM.
You did not go there. You went there.
Okay. I did. They're being well compensated for these jabs. All right, well, that was the last story for the day. Ethan, if folks want to find out more from you, where can they go?
You can go to ethancbanks.com on my About page. We'll link you to all the places I am, including packetpushers.net, of course.
And I'm Drew Connery Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. I blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsor, Thousand Eyes, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, tell a friend, like us on Facebook, or leave a recommendation on iTunes, because that really helps. Check out our membership program at ignition.packetpushers.net. It's got free and paid membership options and includes Human Infrastructure Magazine, Link Propagation, and those VDC videos we talked about. And as always, thanks for listening.